sweeping budget cuts proposed for the Environmental Protection Agency, reducing its workforce by 20%, have some worried. One former staffer just doesn't see it.
You know, a lot of what they're proposing, I think, is just simply unrealistic.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, what a smaller EPA could mean for clean air and water, right down to the state and local levels. Plus, activists on a Pennsylvania farm are taking courage from the example set by Dakota Access Pipeline protests.
Yeah, I'm willing to get arrested. It's a cause worth getting arrested for.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Last month, we told you about a Pittsburgh t-shirt maker selling a design on its website promoting resistance to the Trump administration. It featured a bear wearing a hat. It turns out the t-shirt has come to the attention of the U.S. government, which thinks that creature looks like one of its creations, Smokey Bear. Now the government is demanding the company stop selling the shirt. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
It was a simple enough design, a bear staring out from under the brim of a hat that has the word resist on it. Here's Jay Finelli, co-founder and lead designer for the t-shirt maker Cotton Bureau, speaking with the Allegheny Front last month.
The bear is, I would say he's angry, maybe a little judgmental. He's sort of looking over the brim of his hat.
The shirt was one of several on the company's website with anti-Trump messages that have done well since the election. But this week, Finelli got a cease and desist letter from a company called the Metis Group, which oversees licensing for Smokey Bear for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Libby Cavalakis, owner of the Metis Group, says you can't use Smokey to make political statements.
He's not a political figure. He doesn't have a political view. He's an American icon for wildfire prevention.
This isn't Smokey's first experience in the heat of political battle. His image has been used to protest logging and fracking and discuss other issues.
We had a lot of Smokey Bear smoking marijuana, right? Everyone thought that was a funny use of Smokey.
Congress actually passed a Smokey Bear Act in the 50s, giving the USDA exclusive control over his image. But the question of whether the government's claim over Smokey violates the First Amendment hasn't really been tested all that much in court, says the University of Pittsburgh School of Law's Michael Madison.
There's not a lot of precedent on this. It's not like Smokey Bear has been in court a lot.
In the 90s, a court sided with environmental groups who were using Smokey to protest U.S. Forest Service practices. Cotton Bureau, which declined to comment, no longer has the t-shirt on its website. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
As a candidate, Donald Trump promised to drastically reduce the Environmental Protection Agency. A recent memo by the White House Office of Management and Budget indicates that's still the plan. The memo outlines a proposed 25% cut to EPA's $8 billion budget, eliminating state grants for programs like those that address diesel emissions or radon, and reducing funding by a third for programs that deal with air and water quality and even lead. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, where we look at environmental policy under the new administration, we explored this proposed shrinking of the EPA with our guests, Emily Holden, a reporter with E&E News, and Liz Perchia-Gannon, former director of communications at EPA, now head of RIF City Strategies. Here's a piece of our conversation where Liz begins by weighing in on the feasibility of the proposed budget cuts.
I think a lot of the cuts that they're proposing just are simply not realistic. They want to reduce staff by 3,000 or so, from 15,000 to 12,000. To do that in 1 year, I think, is simply impossible. The agency cut 3,000 staff in a period between 2002 and 2014. That's over a decade to accomplish that. I think this goes to kind of additionally show how naive a lot of the people are that are working in the Trump administration who don't really fully understand how the federal bureaucracy works.
I'm not exactly sure I understand how the federal bureaucracy works because I'm thinking about like staff cuts of that size. And I'm wondering, you know, how does that impact what actually happens in the agency? Is that scientific research? Is it enforcement?
Both. I mean, I think there's serious work that the agency does that protects our public health. For example, enforcement. You know, the VW scandal never would have fully come about without the staff in the Ann Arbor, Michigan lab who were doing the testing on these vehicles and other vehicles to ensure that they were playing by the rules and not cheating on their air emissions. Last year, I don't know if you're familiar with what happened in the Virgin Islands with a family from Pennsylvania that was poisoned by methyl bromide that was illegally applied in their hotel room. And the family was severely injured and, will never recover to how they were before this trip. And it was the work of EPA that identified what had happened and is now holding those companies responsible. And if you don't have an agency with an enforcement staff and an ability to research and dig into these issues, we'll see more cases. It's the work of the agency in these regional offices that are helping states address what's going on.
Liz, maybe it's good to note that EPA, aside from having headquarters here in D.C., where we are, has 10 regional offices with a lot of staff. So these people are spread across the country, too. And so we'll see if, lawmakers in Congress really want to shut down those offices or really make them a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. On the enforcement question, ENE News actually reported that there was some consideration being given by the White House to just shutting down the enforcement shop at EPA entirely. And I chatted with a woman who worked for EPA under the Reagan administration, where that's pretty much what they did. They basically said, do not go out and pursue cases. And she said that just meant there was no cop on the beat. So businesses felt, at least for a couple of years before there was a change at EPA, that they could get away with what they wanted.
Yeah, I think the agency just in the last couple of weeks has already signaled that's the direction they're going in. I mean, we just last week saw that they decided to cancel the information collection request from methane pollution by the oil and gas industry. So if the agency isn't being given the data about pollution that's occurring, there's nothing that the agency can do to actually enforce the laws and ensure that polluters aren't operating on a level playing field.
That was Emily Holden with ENE News and Liz Perchia-Gannon, former EPA official on our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more from the conversation at trumponearth.org, and you can subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on iTunes. Catch up on episodes and stay tuned for upcoming ones, including a look at changes at the Department of Agriculture. That's at trumponearth.org. We're co-producing the podcast with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. But let's get back to the Environmental Protection Agency. The budget cuts the Trump administration wants include reductions to state grants for clean air and water programs. And David Hess says that's a problem for Pennsylvania. Hess now works for Creasy Associates on government affairs for environmental groups and companies. But in the 90s, he was secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection. He says 30% of DEP's budget comes from the EPA.
It helps pay for air pollution reduction, regulating underground storage tanks. There are a whole lot of different programs that EPA money pays for, including things like stream restoration.
Hess says DEP's already been operating with fewer resources than it needs to do its job. The department's share of the state's general fund has been cut by 40% over the last 14 years, and staff has been reduced.
The department has been in triage mode, really, for the last decade.
It's simple math, Hess says. There aren't enough people working at DEP to keep up with the thousands of permit applications or inspections. Late last year, DEP received a letter from EPA admonishing the agency for failing to conduct the minimum number of inspections for drinking water systems across the state. Hess says losing funding through EPA won't help. And he says it's not just the environment that loses out if DEP doesn't review permits in a timely way. It holds up business and development and costs Pennsylvania money. He says slashing regulations isn't the answer either.
I certainly agree with people that things can be simplified, but it's got to be simplified and streamlined without getting rid of protection.
There's more at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. One environmental initiative on President Trump's chopping block is restoration of the Great Lakes. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has more.
In the late 1960s, Lake Erie was a poster child for pollution. But after environmental reforms, it went from what some consider a dead lake to the walleye capital of the world. Now, proposed EPA budget numbers indicate money for the Great Lakes could be cut 97%. That would mean $290 million less coming to the region. Ohio State University biologist Jeff Reuter says the proposed funding cuts would be devastating. He's already worried about recent algae blooms on the lake.
Lake Erie won't manage itself. Without a strong EPA, Lake Erie is likely to continue to deteriorate and go back to the conditions that we had in the 1970s.
The Great Lakes congressional delegation is already taking action. Some lawmakers have written to President Trump about the importance of efforts to stop invasive Asian carp from entering the lakes. The lawmakers say it could harm the multi-billion dollar recreation industry. And Molly Flanagan says even a day at the beach could become dangerous. Flanagan is with the Alliance for the Great Lakes. She says money for states and tribes to monitor beaches for harmful bacteria is at risk.
The monitoring and the notification programs are what let you and your family know whether it's safe to swim.
Flanagan is still hopeful. She says the efforts enjoy immense bipartisan support, and she hopes lawmakers will be able to fight the cuts. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
President Trump is a friend to the oil and gas industry, but having friends in high places only goes so far.
That is not changing the opposition that we have at a local level.
Later on the Allegheny Front, oil and gas pipeline protests in Pennsylvania are just getting started under the Trump administration. Stay tuned. Well, we mentioned our Trump on Earth podcast earlier in the show, and another organization taking a close look at environmental policy changes under the Trump administration is the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It's important to track and have a clear record that people can go back to over time.
That's Susan Casey Lefkowitz, program manager at NRDC. She says their online Trump Watch is a tool for people concerned about changes, such as Congress rolling back late Obama-era protections, including a rule which required oil and gas and mining companies to disclose payments to foreign governments. The NRDC has been an early and frequent critic of the new administration and has already filed lawsuits, including one over the executive order requiring agencies to identify two regulations to cut for every new regulation they propose. I asked Casey Lefkowitz how that would even work at the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, it's sort of a ridiculous order. I mean, it goes beyond the president's authority under the Constitution. You cannot just rewrite laws by personal fiat, and requiring a federal agency to violate their legal obligations to protect the public just doesn't make any sense. And so there's really no way that it could legally work. It's sort of this random concept that I actually can't see a way that it would work in practice. It defies law and it defies common sense.
And some of the other suits that NRDC has filed in with other organizations have to do with federal protection for a bumblebee. And also there's a mercury protection rule.
Both the bumblebee and the mercury protection rule came about because the Trump administration put a freeze on new regulations. And so what EPA then did is they withdrew a rule designed to protect the public from mercury because of this freeze. To undo a safeguard, a regulation that's already in place, what the EPA actually has to do is go through the full process that they would go through in setting the regulation in the first place. And so to simply pull the rule out and say that it's over instead of having that full process, it's not following the process that we've set up in law. And so similarly with the rusty patch bumblebee endangered species listing, you know, putting a freeze on that species listing, especially for a critically endangered bumblebee that really can't wait for protection, it violates the law and it violates common sense and, you know, the interest of the public in seeing species that are as important to us as bees.
Because of pollination and all the things they do for us.
Yeah, I mean, the rusty patch bumblebee is truly one of the critically endangered ones. It's lost about 90% of its range in just 20 years. And, you know, bees are important for our agriculture. They're important for the health of nature around us. They're a really critical part of the ecosystem that improves life for people all across our country. And they're under a lot of pressure right now.
Climate change is a big priority for NRDC, and it's obviously not for the Trump administration. Some of its appointees, like Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, have acknowledged its existence, but hedged on how much people are contributing to climate change. Of course, many Republicans in Congress have said much the same over the years. How much does this kind of thinking concern you at this highest level of government, and how do you as an organization fight against that?
It's very concerning. What we're looking ahead towards is a series of attacks on climate protection standards in the United States. For example, the Clean Power Plan that was the U.S. regulating for the first time climate-destroying emissions from power plants, and the Clean Car Standards, which was a very effective way of limiting climate pollution from cars and other vehicles. And luckily, because they are regulations that are in place, again, Trump can't just undo them by fiat, nor can Administrator Pruitt. They have to go through the full process of rulemaking to undo them. And so it's going to be a long, hard fight that they're facing, because these are very popular rules. People want to move ahead with clean energy in our country.
The public?
Yeah, the public has overwhelmingly said that they care about a healthy climate and they care about clean energy, and that going back to a time of dependence on fossil fuels just doesn't make sense to most people, not when they know that renewable energy and energy efficiency are a path forward that we already see working in practice. It makes economic sense. In fact, it's a huge economic and jobs opportunity.
Do you think that people do understand that connection? Like, they maybe they want clean air and clean water, but don't necessarily connect it to these rulemaking or these pieces of legislation that are happening in Washington now?
Part of our job is to help make that connection. Yeah. I think that when we look back, for example, at the time before the EPA was created, it was a time of intense pollution in our country. We had rivers catching on fire. We had smog and air pollution events. In fact, I was just reading there was one in Donora, Pennsylvania, which was a mill town where 20 people died in the late 1940s. That is not a time that people want to go back to. And so connecting the dots between how important the Environmental Protection Agency is and how important our air protections and water protections and climate protections are for us to have the kind of healthy environment that we've gotten used to and that we need to continue improving still for so many communities in the U.S. That's part of our job as NRDC, to make sure that people do understand the importance of these institutions and these laws.
We are just six or seven weeks into this presidency now. How are environmentalists and groups like yours going to be able to keep up the pressure on the administration at this rate?
You know, that's something that we've put a lot of thought into. And one is litigation is going to be an important tool for us in the months and years to come. The other is it's more important than ever for members of Congress and members of the administration to be hearing from the public. And so activating our members to get people out on the streets, to have people calling, to have people sending letters. The next two big events in Washington, D.C. is going to be a scientists march on Earth Day in late April. And then at the very end of April, at the 100-day mark of the Trump administration, there's going to be the People's Climate March in Washington, D.C. with sister marches around the country. And I think that it's sustainable to continue to show the administration. And frankly, the staff at NRDC, like, I think for all of us, we can't think of any place we'd rather be working right now.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Susan Casey Lefkowitz is program manager at the Natural Resources Defense Council. There's a link to their Trump Watch at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Some people are energized or re-energized by what's happening or could happen to the environment under President Trump. Some are depressed. Others are fearful. Pittsburgher and social justice advocate Heather McLean has this take.
Every afternoon for the last 2 months, I've had the same experience. I'm at work, at my desk, and my phone screen lights up with a news notification. I see that NPR News logo at the top, but I'm hesitant to open it. One day the headline read, Army approves Dakota Access Pipeline route, paving way for... I knew it was going to be more bad news. I felt a sense of dread and a sense of duty to read on. This prompted me to later express my concern and frustration on Facebook. Linking to the NPR story, I wrote, "I'm so sick of getting an NPR update on my phone and having to brace for awful news. I can't unplug because I care too much, but how do I keep my chest from tightening with every uncaring, myopic, and hasty announcement?" I later wondered if my commentary was too self-absorbed. But by the time I looked back at the post, some of my friends had responded with practical advice on how to cope. They said things like, take breaks from social media, exercise, try to live in joy, try boxing. I appreciated these instructional responses, especially the idea of hitting something, but the sentiments felt detached and superficial to me because just that week, the East End of Pittsburgh had been under a boil water advisory. At the reproductive justice organization where I work, we dropped everything to collect and distribute water within the communities of color that we serve. We shared printouts on what families could do to make sure they use their tap water safely. It's more complicated than you'd think. The whole situation emphasized the fact that our lives can be upended at any moment. I've never been as frequently reminded of that fact as I have in the last few months. Trump's moving forward with the Dakota Access Pipeline, despite what could happen if there's a spill. It feels like his administration's doing away with protections, I'll admit, I'd taken for granted. It makes me physically and mentally exhausted. Is this the new normal? If so, how do we handle it? How do I handle it? I'd like to start by staying attuned to what's happening within my own world. The thing about the boil water advisory was it put my work life into perspective. We're focused on the policies that benefit the health and well-being of Black women and girls, but we don't always get to step into the community with such urgency. I don't live in the neighborhoods that were affected, but that experience made it personal to me. Thinking back on how people responded to my Dakota Access Pipeline post, I would have loved for someone to simply say, hey, let's go for a drink, or why don't we go for a hike this weekend? To respond with support, not just advice. It's tempting to glance at Facebook posts and make brief comments or click like, then move on with what we're doing, but it's human connection that can keep us from feeling psychologically beaten by the overwhelming news cycle. If we want to stay focused on how it's all affecting the things that are important to us, like clean water and access to healthcare, we've got to stay in touch with each other.
Heather McLean works for New Voices for Reproductive Justice, a grassroots organization focused on the health and well-being of women, femmes, and girls of color. You'll find more essays on topics from bike camping to raising turkeys. That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. So some activists are taking inspiration from protests by Native Americans against the Dakota Access Pipeline. They've launched an encampment on a farm in Lancaster County in an attempt to physically block construction of the Atlantic Sunrise gas pipeline. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, the camp is just one of many pipeline battles brewing across Pennsylvania and around the nation.
There's a big barn in southern Lancaster County with freshly painted red letters on the side. It reads, "Welcome to the Stand." Mark Clatterbuck is one of the activists with the group Lancaster Against Pipelines, leading the charge against the Atlantic Sunrise. It's a new $3 billion pipeline designed to move natural gas southward through 10 Pennsylvania counties.
Okay, so right behind us is this old historic tobacco barn that we're using as kind of the base of the kind of base of operations, where that's where we're storing donations, food donations, as well as supplies, camping supplies, tarps.
The owners of this property in Conestoga Township refused to make a deal with Williams, the company behind the Atlantic Sunrise project. Now, portions of the farm may be taken through eminent domain. But the opponents are organized. The campsite has a food truck, a large military tent, a pair of portable toilets, and on a recent Saturday, crews were installing power in the barn.
Yeah, we're running electric and we'll run cable here, so we have internet as well.
Nearby, about 24 people rehearsed scenarios for nonviolent direct action.
And we, the majority of the people, are silenced more and more. And until we stand up in masses, that's not going to change.
While the pipeline construction hasn't started yet, the camp emerged in mid-February, shortly after federal regulators approved the project. Someone is here around the clock. So far, about two dozen people have camped out on weekends, with fewer people staying during the week. Molly Wallace lives in Leola and says she's probably too much of a wuss to pitch a tent and stay overnight, but she wants to make her voice heard.
Yeah, I'm willing to get arrested. It's a cause worth getting arrested for.
This cause is at the center of other battles over the Mariner and Penn East pipelines in Pennsylvania and other big projects in places like Louisiana, Florida, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. While pipelines aren't a new thing, this nationwide proliferation of projects is, and it's all because of the shale boom, which unlocked huge reserves of natural gas and oil. Chris Stockton is a spokesman for Williams. He says the supply center for fossil fuels has shifted dramatically.
You know, pipelines are one of these things. They're normally out of sight, out of mind. People don't give a whole lot of thought to them or think about where their natural gas comes from. But, you know, this shale development has really turned our industry upside down.
And while President Donald Trump is viewed as friendly to the oil and gas industry, Williams CEO Alan Armstrong warned his colleagues at a conference earlier this year in Pittsburgh that they shouldn't get too complacent because of this new administration.
That is not changing the opposition that we have at a local level. And we're going to continue to see that. And I would tell you, it may even enhance.
It's true activists are taking tips and inspiration from each other. Stephanie Graybill runs the kitchen at the Lancaster encampment.
I have one here.
Her food truck is painted like a cow with black and white spots and fits right in on the farm. She's one of several people from central Pennsylvania who traveled to North Dakota for the Standing Rock protest last year.
I was scared. I was scared because it was so cold. I'd never experienced weather like that in my life, and the wind, it was just brutal.
But now she's sitting out in the sunshine on an unseasonably warm winter day with her two daughters, 21-month-old Ella and 12-year-old Maddie, who's strumming the ukulele. Graybill says about six people she met at Standing Rock are making their way out to Pennsylvania in the next few weeks.
I think Standing Rock's the playbook for camps like ours, because we're tired of government pushing us around. They're supposed to be working for us, not working against us.
It's unclear how this encampment will unfold. At times, violence erupted between law enforcement and the North Dakota protesters. And in Florida recently, a man was killed by police after he fired a gun at pipeline construction equipment. But so far, the Lancaster activists seem to have a positive relationship with officers. Corporal John Mishner of the Southern Regional Police stopped by to share a weather warning.
I mean, I just stopped down because I heard on the radio there's a severe thunderstorm warning for the area, and I wanted to make sure they were aware.
And as opponents continue to organize against their pipeline, Williams says it respects the rights of people to protest peacefully. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And there's a development to this story. State Impact Pennsylvania reports that Conestoga Township has placed notices on the barn at the site of the encampment. They say building codes don't permit the barn to be used for non-agricultural purposes, and the farm isn't zoned for events like protests. The municipality is threatening to fine the property owners $1,000 a day. There's more at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.